We were having fun yesterday, Mr.
Chairman. Would you tell me what happened, please?
I
had to go to the governor's office and left you alone.
We moved all the bills.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, we were right in the middle of discussion on the, on,
150,
and we had just defeated a motion to accept the new proposed finance, yes, and Representative Swackhammer has another change to present today.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Swackhammer, I am now, with the failure of that adoption, I have before me committee substitute for Senate Bill 150 finance before me.
I would like to move to rescind our action yesterday and like to give you a brief explanation. It'd be my intentions to offer back the committee substitute that failed yesterday with an amendment that's being passed out now that would add on page 1, line 26, or after June 30, 1988, just so that anybody that have apprehensions about rescinding would know what my intentions are.
Okay, let's wait till we get the... Basically, this takes about three particular motions. The first motion, if Representative Swackhammer, he's going to have a rescinding motion. If that particular rescinding motion does pass, then we have before us basically an adoption for a House committee substitute. Once that adoption has taken place, then it's up to the committee if they have an amendment. And amendment number one would then be before you. Your motion for rescinding.
Yes, I would so move and ask for unanimous consent.
Is there any objection? Hearing no objection.
I object.
Representative Frank, rescinding motion.
Yeah, I'm just a little uncomfortable. I thought yesterday we had a consensus that we didn't want to have a moratorium on the program or a cutoff of the program. I guess a moratorium's better, but I'm still concerned about it, not having had a chance to talk with my people about this proposal, my district people. I'm not sure whether Fairbanks School District envisions a new school because of the light infantry division or not. I rather doubt it, but I'm not sure, and I'd hate to do it without an opportunity to consult with my school district.
Mr. Chairman, this was the best compromise that we could work out. We could find no one that had intentions of going to bond for schools this next year, and besides, the Fairbanks District has $40 million worth of unissued bonds at the time. We don't feel that that's going to be a problem, and also we'll offer intent language that we will have a new statute next year. It's in your packet.
Representative Davis?
Say, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, I didn't catch the last sentence. You said you will have intent language that...
There is intent language in your packet that I will offer after I can get the bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Brown.
I don't believe I have any intent
I don't have
language.
That intent language either.
It was in your packet yesterday. It's attached to the bill. The front page.
Oh.
To the CS that we talked about.
Okay. Yes, Representative Davis.
Let me just see if I have this language correct here. My understanding was this was a moratorium for 1 year, and then the law goes back into effect as it was before. Is that correct? With the adoption of these amendments and the legislation, is that correct?
Yes. First, I want to rescind our actions from yesterday.
I understand that. I just want to know what path we're going down. Thank you. Thanks.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I was passed a note by my staff. It says 180 Helms did agree to the proposal. Task force contacted her last evening. Mm-hmm.
Is there any further discussion on the rescinded motion? Is there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move committee substitute dated 5/12/87. That has in the top right corner a new draft to be proposed by Representative Swackhammer.
A motion is before you to adopt House Committee Substitute for Senate Bill Number 150 Finance. Is there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. I have the bill before me. I have an amendment before me, Representative Swackhammer.
Yes, I had to move amendment number one and number two.
Representative Pritchell, there's objection.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder, Representative Swackhammer, if you could, I can't read Amendment Number 2. Where does that go?
Okay, if you'll take a look on the bottom of page 1, in the last two words, including estimated annual operations, and then would be comma, estimated total interest and maintenance costs. This was the amendment that Senator Fisher had talked about, and it was his desire that the voters see the total monies that they were going to pay for any particular bond issue.
Total.
So I go from the bottom of line 1 to the top of page 2.
The chair is going to divide the amendments. There are two amendments on one page. I'm going to divide it up to Amendment Number 1 and Amendment Number 2. We'll be taking separate votes on those.
Okay. Could I just speak to Amendment Number 1? Basically, what Amendment Number 1 does is that it puts the reimbursing funding question back into effect after June 30, 1988. There's a one-year moratorium.
Move it.
Yes, I do move it.
Is there any objection to Amendment Number 1? Hearing none, Amendment Number 1 has been adopted. Amendment Number 2.
I would move that, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any objection to Amendment Number 2?
Object.
There's objections. Representative Frank.
For the purposes of a friendly amendment that I'm drafting right now.
Okay. I can wait and get somebody
else. Yeah, could you wait for a second, please?
Representative Larson, let's continue while he's drafting.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not really objecting to the amendment, although I think it's something that isn't absolutely necessary. Each and every one of us in our everyday life, when we go and purchase a car, we say the price of our car was $12,000. We don't say it was $12,000 plus $7,000 interest, and therefore the price of our car was $19,000. Because the price of a school is $12 million if you pay cash. So I just think it's not necessary, but I don't have so strong feelings that I wouldn't vote for the motion.
Yes, Representative Pritchell.
Mr. Chairman, I tend to agree. If you include also by law estimated amounts that will be paid by the state and by the municipality, that seems to be of more direct interest. We're looking at this right now in this point of time in this forum as limitations on the issuance of state-backed or state-reimbursed bond debt. But many times in our own communities, we have been in the position of trying to promote the passage of school bonds to construct needed school bonds. And, if we just think about wearing that hat for a little bit, as a proponent of trying to have voter approval of necessary school bonds, I'm not sure that, that doesn't help this cause if you scare away people with a big number that doesn't influence the cost of that project beyond what's stated by the other part of the estimated amounts that will be paid by the state and by the municipality. Payment is payment. And in our school district, they put in what it means to your mill rate. And I think Representative Frank said yesterday that probably is more meaningful than just saying, in addition, you're going to have to pay $200 million worth of total interest over the life of the project. That doesn't happen in 1 year, and it's not particularly meaningful.
Mr. Chairman, I can just tell you what Senator Fisher's concerns were, that when we had so many bond issues on the ballot, it appeared that our district and at least one other went heavily into debt, and it was his feeling that if the total amount of money were stated into the bond, that we wouldn't have had so many bonds issued. That it was Senator Fisher's desire to add this amendment, I told him that I would offer the amendment.
Representative Rieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I tend to agree with the former statements. It is true that in some of the truth in lending policies, when you do buy a house, look in the fine print, they do tally up all the interest, and you get this phenomenal number. So it's not that it's unprecedented, but I think, in general, it misleads more than it gives an accurate portrayal. So I agree with Representative Pritchell.
Representative Larson.
I was just going to say, at the time you go to election to ask the voters to approve bonds, you really don't know what the interest rates are going to be when you sell those bonds, and therefore, at best, it would be an estimate to what the interest charges are.
Representative Frank.
Yeah, working off of Representative Rieger's analogy here with a house payment or with a house loan, I think the thing that people are more concerned about than the total interest they pay over the life of the loan is what their monthly payments are going to be, and that's the spirit of my friendly amendment to the amendment, which would say something like this. It's probably not drafted terribly. well, but it's and the approximate amount that would be due in annual taxes on a $100,000 home to retire this debt. That would, the attempt is to give somebody something they can relate to. I think that taxpayers should know what they're going to have to pay for what they're going to buy. I think where I come from, I don't know that we've ever turned down a school bond request, and I'm certainly not trying to reduce the number of schools built or anything like that. But I think it is relevant to have people understand what they're paying, what they're going to be asked to pay for this. And I don't think I couldn't figure out what a $20 million school was to me. And I've got quite a bit of background in both finance and in government affairs now after a couple of years here. You know, I wouldn't know how to relate to that. But if somebody said, well, you're gonna, it's going to be, you know, the annual debt service is going to be, you know, it would mean $200 per year to you if you got a $100,000 house, I think people can relate to that. If they know that the state can pay up to 80%, you know, they can relate to that too. They probably won't tend to. I don't know. Maybe they'll tend to. Maybe they'll. If they're smart, I guess they would add it to their normal tax bill. You know, and maybe I'm paying $1,000 now in annual property taxes, and if I add this on, then we're going to pay an additional $100 or $35 or whatever it may be. Any person can make a rational choice about that. I don't think that's inappropriate.
Did you have an amendment to the amendment?
Yeah. I just read it. Do you want me to have it typed?
Mr. Chairman? I just need for you to move it so we can
debate
it.
Okay, I'll move it.
Would you state it again for the members, please?
Whether or not, I think it's more important, first of all, let me say, than the estimated total interest. But I'll make it as a friendly amendment to this amendment and see how far we get with that. And it would read, after the interest, comma, and the approximate amount that would be due in annual taxes on a $100,000 home to retire this debt.
Okay. There's objection, Representative Larson.
Yes, I'm not really objecting, but I think the motion to amend here is a little misleading when you say a $100,000 home. That makes it think that only people are paying tax on their home. If you said $100,000 in assessed value.
Okay, I was thinking of it. Okay.
You know, I could support the amendment.
I know. Okay. I certainly accept that.
Representative Brown, on the amendment to the amendment.
Well, I like the concept of the amendment. I'm wondering, perhaps someone who has more experience in local government, is this going to be a fixed number that will be ascertainable and clear? Because it seems to me that there are a variety of ways that a municipality might be paying off this debt or a local community. So.
Mr. Chairman, I would envision that the municipality would have to, first of all, say under the present conditions where the state is expected to pay back 80%, this is the amount of assessed value, or amount that you would have to pay per $100,000 of assessed value in local property taxes for the local share.
Mr. Thompson, the chair calls up Mr. Thompson to, as a municipality, to reply to this particular issue. We are looking at an amendment to the amendment, and you have heard the debate. I'd like to hear your comments as far as your municipality is concerned with this readout.
Thank you. We have no particular objection as it was originally proposed, but I do agree that there's no way that we can accurately say what the cost is going to be on a $100,000 home, or either that, or that we can say what the increased mill rate would be. We can, and our borough has put on in the past, and I thought we all did, but perhaps not, the estimated total cost and the estimated amount that the state is going to contribute.
Representative Brown, further questions to the municipality?
Well, I'm just wondering, under the current conditions, whether it's reasonable for local communities to expect an 80% reimbursement from the state.
Mr. Chairman, that was my comment. I'm having a hard time expressing myself here because there are so many unknowns that at best it's going to be someone's best estimate on the ballot. And I think the way it's done now, at least I've always been, you know, satisfied with it and thought it portrayed a pretty clear picture.
Representative Frank.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. I use the word in my amendment that's being typed now. I use the word approximate, and we could water it down from there, even if members felt that was necessary. But I think the thrust of my idea is to try to get something that people can relate to, and I just know that they can't relate to the $20 million figure. Might as well be 20 billion or 20,000. I don't know. It's just hard to, you know. I don't think we ought to bring it back to something that normal person can understand and relate to, and therefore make a good value judgment. You know, I think it will also, I think it'll bring more cost benefit analysis into the schools that we build and that sort of thing, and we don't have to say, it doesn't have to be specific. It could be approximate. Personally, I think it ought to be something like, this is what the total cost would be, and the state may pay up to 80% under current law, or something like that, with the words may underlined, or something like that.
Mr. Thompson.
There is another point that I didn't mention, which is that when we go out to sell the bonds, or go to a vote of the bonds, it can be several months before we actually sell the bonds. There can be an entirely different interest rate by that time. Again, you're right, and I don't disagree at all with what you're trying to do, but I think we're going to have to be very careful as to saying that you will say exactly or even approximately, because it could be misleading. In fact, right now, I've been getting a lot of criticism from the public saying, you, meaning the borough, said that the state was going to reimburse 80%, and the governor says they're going to reimburse 56%. You misled us, meaning the borough people. We tried not to, but maybe we did. And I think that's what we have to be careful of in this, too. Thank you.
Representative Davis, did you have further?
No.
Representative Davis.
Well, I have the same concern with the amendment, but I think it goes farther than it's sort of that whole paragraph. It says the estimated total payments is kind of bogus, because we don't know what could be 80% next year, could be 90%, could be 70%. So I wonder if we should maybe see the way that this whole thing reads. And I'm sorry, Representative Frank, I don't know how it sort of meshes in here, but it says in here the estimated total cost of each project, which is, and the annual maintenance cost. And then it says the estimated amounts we paid for will be paid for by the state and by the municipality. And I just wonder if we could sort of work that whole.
Yeah, I agree. I think we need to rework the whole thing and make it closer to reality. I mean, the state is clearly in a position where it's deciding whether or not to pay, and the voters ought to know that. They ought to know that it's not a sure thing, that we have an opportunity for, the law provides, the state the ability to pay, or the authority to pay, but not necessarily the will to pay.
I just wonder, if I could continue, Mr. Chairman, if this...
Yes, we're talking on the amendment to the amendment.
Right, well, if this whole thrust of this language here... not underlined, so I don't know if it's already in there or not, but if that's a whole new section. Is that the way it reads in the
yes,
existing
yes.
language?
Yes.
Because I thought in some other place it says up to.
We're looking at down in the lower left, the municipality to include on the ballot for the bond issue the estimated total cost and the approximation. That's where we're reading off the bottom there on page one.
Okay, so that's existing language then. I just don't think it's clear.
Is there any objections to the amendment to the amendment?
I object, Mr. Chairman.
There's still objection?
Just a brief statement, Mr. Chairman. At first I thought, you know, it might be a good idea, but I guess the more I look at it, the more confusing I think it would be, that the present method of which you identify what the true costs are already on the ballot, and therefore, I'd feel uncomfortable adding another burden that may or may not be just someone's best estimate at one particular time.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Weckhammer?
I think there's a couple of points. I think it's obvious that we don't know at what level what the interest rate is going to be, or even at what level that the state is going to reimburse. So I understand what Representative Frank's trying to accomplish there. We have a one-year moratorium on new construction, and if we adopt the intent language, and it's the governor's, it's something that we can work on for new bonds. We're not going to have any new bonds, at least for this 1 year. So it would be our intent to address the type of concerns, and hopefully we'll have a consistent policy on how we're going to deal with schools in the future.
Anything on before we take a roll call, Representative?
Yeah, I was going with you, but then I remembered that we may not have a new policy. We may just go back to this old policy because the moratorium is only for 1 year. And if we can't come up with a better idea, this may be law. So perhaps if there isn't support for this amendment, maybe we ought to just strike that word will there and change it to may on line 2, page 2.
I'm still on amendment to the amendment first.
Okay, well, I guess I'll just keep my amendment out and vote on it, whatever.
Okay, why don't we take a roll call vote.
amendment to the amendment.
Roll call vote.
Representative Adams?
No.
Representative Boyer?
No.
Representative Brown?
Yes.
Representative
Gray?
Yes.
Representative Reaker?
Yes.
Representative
Reaker?
No.
Representative
Blackman? No. Representative Wallace? Motion passes. We're back to the main amendment. Is there any further discussion? Is there any objection to amendment number 2?
Okay.
There's still objection? Roll call vote, please. Yes.
Representative Boyer? No. Representative Dahl? No. Representative Pichot? Yes. Representative Wall?
We have adopted number 2. Is there further amendments? Representative Frank?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Page 2?
Page 2, line 2, change the word will to may.
You have amendment number 3 that is moved by Representative Frank. Is there any objection?
I'll object for the purposes of a question, Mr. Chairman.
That's not necessarily a very good amendment.
do you withdraw your amendment?
Well, yeah, I think I'll withdraw my amendment and rethink it because what the state doesn't pay, the municipality has to pay, so...
Amendment number 3 has been withdrawn. Is there any further amendments to come before us? Is there anybody else that would like to testify on the bill? What's the pleasure of the group?
I'd like to move the intent language.
Let's move the bill first, huh? Move the bill.
Yes, I move the bill out of committee, the individual recommendation.
Is there any objections?
Just for the purpose of a comment. You know, we spent a lot of time talking about little items in the bill, but I think some of us still have some concerns as to what it means in terms of future dollars and future reimbursement by the state. And in some cases, frankly, a parochial concern, what it means when you reimburse some communities who opt to refund more money over a longer period of time than others who opt not to refund. And I'm not going to hold up the bill, but I'm still a little undecided as to the total effect of the bill, and I don't necessarily believe the estimates of the supplied by the administration, because they used estimates as if every single issue possible were refunded, and that's I don't think that's the case. And so maybe between the time this leaves and goes to the bill, maybe we can get some more estimates as to what the financial implications are, assuming that the most pressing bonds are refunded. I remove my objection.
There's no objections. Further comments? Representative Frank.
Yes, I have a new amendment, Mr. Chairman.
We have a motion before us.
How should I proceed then?
You would ask the maker of the amendment to withdraw his...
Yeah, okay. Could I ask the maker of the amendment to withdraw the motion? Because I'd like to go back to that earlier idea of taking the will out and changing it to may. And I think if we add some additional language, so that would read like this. And maintenance costs and the estimated amounts that may be paid by the state and the balance that will be paid by the municipality.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Swackhammer, there has been a request by the...
I'll withdraw it, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, sir. At this time, the maker has withdrawn his motion to move out of committee. Representative Frank,
Yes, I've moved my amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. There's objection. Representative Larson.
Yeah, when we put may be paid by the state and the balance will be paid by the municipality, I don't know if that's any more clear than what's already in there. Because if the state underpays its 80% or 70%, whatever it is, it's impossible to estimate then what amount will be paid by the municipality. So,
yeah.
So I think the amendment is just as confusing as the...
Well, it probably is. I'm just trying to get at something that will take that language in there that lulls us into this feeling that the state's going to pay. And obviously the state hasn't expressed or hasn't paid 100% for at least the last 2 years. And, boy, there's certainly no guarantees, and I hate to imply a guarantee because you get Mayor Thompson in trouble.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I support what Representative Frank is trying to do because I think, in the long-term interest of both the state and the local taxpayers, it would be better if this were more clearly worded. And I'm, wondering if we maybe should just take a little more time to write this amendment and bring this up at the end of this meeting. Because it seems to me that it would read better if you said in the estimated amounts of obligation or the estimated obligation that's going to be borne by the municipality or undertaken by the municipality, and then in a separate clause or phrase address the fact that the state may or may not offset part of that obligation.
Mr. Chairman?
We're working on Amendment Number 3, which is Representative Frank's amendment. Representative Larson?
Thank you. I may need some help from Mayor Thompson, but it's my recollection that within the proposition for a bond issue that municipalities place before the voters, there are certain requirements that they must advertise over a period of time in a newspaper of wide circulation, in which they must state really the existing laws under which the bonds are being issued under. And it seems to me that everything is thoroughly disclosed within that disclosure for ballot proposition. And I guess, are we asking to have that repeated again on the ballot? I just think that, the process that's established already is pretty clear, and the people have an opportunity if they take that opportunity.
I think you're correct, Representative Larson. The opportunity is there if the people take the opportunity. Unfortunately, a lot of times they don't, as we all know. I don't see any advantage in changing the wording. I see what we're trying to get at, but I don't know that we're really accomplishing anything by so doing. Let's put it this way, and I don't mean this the way it sounds. I think the people right now have a better understanding that the state may not live up to its obligation than they had a couple of years ago.
Actions speak louder than words.
Right.
On the amendment, further discussion, Representative Davis.
Yeah, I agree with what Representative Frank's trying to do, but I think perhaps this could be addressed in a letter of intent or something that when it's advertised that the state will pay up to a certain amount, that there's a little asterisk there saying, given the track record of the legislature or something, but I don't think we need to put it in the legislation.
On the amendment.
I'll withdraw my amendment.
Amendment number 3 has been withdrawn. Is there further amendments? Representative Swackhammer, let's try it again.
Mr. Chairman, I move committee substitute one, Senate Bill 150 from committee with individual recommendations.
Is there any objections? Hearing no objections, House committee substitute for Senate Bill number 150, finance amended, is moved out of committee.
Mr. Chairman, I move the proposed intent language for committee substitute 150.
Yeah. There's objection to the movement of the intent language. Representative Rieger.
Chairman, I'd propose to add a number 5 on the intent language. Read as follows. Equity between grant funding of schools and school debt reimbursement.
Is there any objection? Hearing no objection, that language number 5, would you put it in writing and hand it to the secretary, please? Thank you very much. Is there anything else on the intent language? Representative Davis.
Yeah, this is something I thought about, and I don't really know where it could go, and I've just throw it out for discussion, and maybe when this bill comes on the floor, we could talk about it. But it seems like the municipality should have almost like a bond committee or someone, entity of the state that they could go to work with in marketing or refinancing these bonds. And I don't know if that's, it isn't in the legislation, but it would seem like the state certainly in the business of selling bonds and has great expertise in that. And I would like to see the state work closely with these municipalities and forging ahead. Perhaps we could incorporate that in any language on the floor. But Mr. Thompson, if you had any comments on that, I'd appreciate it.
Maybe you don't realize it, but the boroughs, most all of the boroughs now have quite a bit of expertise in working with bonds. We've sold quite a bit. We work with bond counsel very closely. It's maybe there's some way that the state could help out. I really don't know, but I think most of the, at least the boroughs that handle quite a number of bonds have quite a bit of sophistication in that line.
The reason I said that, Mr. Chairman, is that we obviously are going to be incurring long-term debt that's going to be borne by the state, and for that reason, I think the state has an interest in the proceedings.
If I may, the state, I think that's what you're talking about in this setting up the moratorium, to set in a system of what the state's share will be versus what the borough's share will be, if I'm not mistaken, which would handle that question, I believe. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you.
The intent language has been adopted. That bill is moved out of committee. The next bill we'll take up is House Bill number 204. We have before us committee substitute for House Bill number 204 has an act related to the regulation of the practice of occupational therapy and physical therapy and providing for an effective date. This bill provides for the regulation of the profession of occupational therapy under the umbrella of the Physical Therapy Board. It will cost approximately $13,000 to augment the board to cover occupational therapy, and that cost will be borne by the license fees. Here to testify on the bill is Richard Navarre, the sponsor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Mike Navarre. I represent District 5. The chairman has given a real good overview of what the bill does. Most of the bill is just technical language. It adds the occupational therapists into the current licensing procedures for physical therapists. The occupations are closely associated, and this bill has been worked out with both the division and also the occupational therapists and physical therapists in the state. There's a zero fiscal note because the increased cost is borne by the added licensures. And we didn't create a new board. We simply added two occupational therapists to the current five-member board for physical therapy. And that cost is absorbed by the increased licensing fees.
Representative Pershaw.
The question, of course, that comes in the POMs on this is whether or not this would have any effect on the regulation of spiritual healers or people who practice healing who aren't college educated. Does this bill affect people like the late Della Keats or people who practice that type of healing?
Thank you for reminding me to clear that up. No, on page 13, healthcare provider, that language already currently includes, I think it's that one. Anyway, under a section of the law that requires healthcare providers to give notice to the authorities when there has been a case of child abuse, already included in that language is religious healing practitioners. And all we're doing is adding occupational therapy to that section of the law.
Any further questions?
Representative Barr, I didn't find that section on.
Yeah, I don't find it here either. Oh, it's on page 14 at the top of the page, Practitioner of the Healing Arts. And all we do, the language currently has everything in it except for occupational therapists on line 4. Religious healing practitioners on line 6 is already currently in the law, and it requires them, along with all these other practitioners, to report cases of child abuse. And the reason it's not simply in there in underlined language is because the reviser wanted to put them in alphabetical order. And maybe, I've got an old copy of the bill. Maybe they just added the underlined language. We were going to do that.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Brown?
Are we on, is the Hess version the most recent?
It's the Hess version, and it should be about section 27 in it, yeah. Okay, it's section 30 on page 15 of this bill. And on line 24, it has religious healing practitioners. That's where the controversy came in.
That's current law.
Yeah, that's current law.
So I guess my question would be, what is... This current law already applies to them. You're adding some people to it, so there's no change with respect to...
There's no change other than we're adding occupational therapists, occupational therapy assistants, and physical therapy assistants to that requirement for reporting. Religious healing practitioners is already required by law.
Further questions? Representative Rieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one question. On page 12, there's language that says that the board may impose a civil fine of not more than $5,000, and that's the section that was repealed and reenacted. Is the $5,000 civil penalty something that was in existence before in that section, or is that new?
I'm not sure. Representative Rieger, I could check the statutes for you.
I can check it later. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions? What's the pleasure of the group? Representative Pritchell.
I'd move and ask unanimous consent that we report out the SCS for House Bill 205 with the accompanying fiscal note and with individual recommendations.
Is there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. We have committee substitute for House Bill number 213, Transportation, an act relating to the allocation of federal aid highways and providing for an effective date. This bill would change the way in which federal highway aid funds are used in Alaska. We have Representative Hoffman here. After hearing testimony from Representative Hoffman, this bill will go into subcommittee consisting of Representative Adams, Representative Bouchot, and Representative Frank.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I submitted this piece of legislation after trying to work with DOT, trying to get some federal funds for the Bethel Road. And in the process, maybe I could just pass over to the committee. We had an analysis done of federal highway funds by election district. And I went back and looked. I know for a fact that in District 25, we haven't received federal funds for the last 10 years, and in the six-year plan, it's not anticipated that District 25 will receive any federal funds. With that, I looked at Senate District M, which is encompasses an area about the same size as the state of California, and in this district as well, we have not received any federal funds in a period of 10 years. The problem, I guess, that I see with the allocation system is that the state of Alaska, or we as a legislative body, we do not participate in the allocation of federal dollars. I think that's a major policy issue on where dollars should be spent, and it shouldn't be left at the discretion of DOT and their ranking criteria. We as a elected official should be deciding where dollars get spent. In the ranking criteria, there's no provisions or very, very little option for new construction of roads in the state of Alaska. The state of Alaska receives federal highway funds primarily under three criteria. One, we receive them because of the population in the state of Alaska. Two, because of our road mileage, and three, because of the square miles that the state of Alaska has. We have, and because of this, I think that because of the square miles aspect, we in rural Alaska should be receiving federal highway dollars. I don't want to be critical of the of how federal highway dollars are being spent by the state of Alaska, but it seems a little bit absurd to me that we're using part of our federal highway dollars for bike paths in downtown Anchorage, and people in rural Alaska are not even getting $1 to address all of the needs that we have. We have not seen, you know, you look at the the sheet that I passed out in districts 24, 25, 26, and 27. Over a four-year period, we received $900,000 out of, it might be noted that we receive approximately $150 million a year. So this is a $600 million allocation for the state of Alaska in 4 years, and just these four districts. And I might note that District 3 also received only $900,000. So I think that clearly there are some inadequacies in the way that projects are prioritized. And so I've worked out with members of the Transportation Committee what I feel is a little bit more fair and equitable allocation system. And I guess that I might state that I strongly feel that that we as a state have to reprioritize where we're spending federal highway dollars. The primary and the major intent of the federal dollars is to develop a transportation network for the state of Alaska. And with that, the intent should be attention should be placed upon primary roads and secondary roads for getting the masses of the people in the state of Alaska from one point to another point, and it should not be placed. The responsibility of the state of Alaska. So, with this in the six-year plan, I went and analyzed where we are planning, where we are directing our energies. This next year, we're going to spend approximately $44 million on urban roads. In the next subsequent year, we're going to be spending approximately $54 million. And then after that, out of the $150 million, we are going to spend $80 million on urban roads, which I don't think is the responsibility of the state of Alaska. So clearly, I think that there are problems here. And to give you some indication as to the magnitude of this problem, $80 million, we as a state apply our federal funds. We get our federal funds from the state of Alaska, from the federal government. The federal government, under the application process, gives us $3.2 million for urban roads. We are one of two states, or one of two areas in the federal system that receive a waiver from the federal government to in order to spend our dollars, and we don't have any strings attached to our dollars. Puerto Rico and the state of Alaska have this flexibility to spend the dollars the way we feel that we need them. And I think that the reason that we have this flexibility is because we say that we have unique problems in the state of Alaska. And I agree that we have unique problems, but our unique problems aren't urban roads in downtown Anchorage. People say that we don't pay our fair share in rural Alaska. Well, I contend that the state of Alaska doesn't pay its fair share under the federal highway dollar system. We submit under the tax system, we are taxed 9 cents on a gallon. That 9 cents is sent to into Washington, and for every dollar that we put into the program, the state of Alaska receives approximately $9 back. I think that because of this, we as a state are receiving a lot of subsidy from the federal government, and we are asking for waivers. And I think that we as a state are abusing these federal highway dollars. And the intent of my piece of legislation is to bring some resemblance of fairness back to the allocation of our federal dollars. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Davis.
Yeah, questions. Thank you, Chairman. Representative Hoffman, I know that Representative Frischow is certainly looking at the allocation of dollars. It's I've had some discussions with him on this. I guess the question I have on this House research report that you did, I think it tells a story, but I think really it would be good to have House research to go back and take a look at the state dollars that have been spent in those regions, because I know Dillingham for one and Kodiak for another have had bridges and major construction there, and it's all been solely funded with state dollars and no federal dollars, and I think that would you know, now I'm not saying it wouldn't be more accurate, but I think it would be good to take a look at how much state dollars have been spent out there, and admittedly, we're not going to have the capital budgets in the future to address those needs out there, so there needs to be perhaps something done to alleviate those problems in the future, but I think there has been a substantial amount of state dollars spent out there, you can respond to that if you like, but I have a question about the legislation here. I believe on line 29 it talks about not transferring federal highway funds among federal highway programs unless surplus funds exist. After all, on the next page it says, after all highway qualified projects within a federal highway program are funded. And I know there's a lot of ongoing projects in the process of getting work done, and maybe others would like to comment on that, but there's probably more projects underway than they'll ever complete, and I would like to give, personally, like to give them the flexibility to move the money around, not have that restrictions, just so that the highest priority of the state perhaps would be a road in Anchorage versus a road in Fairbanks, and let that get underway rather than have it constricted, and so I guess I have some language. I'm a statesman once in a while, but I guess I have some problems with this language in giving such restrictions to the DOT that they don't have the flexibility to carry out their mission, so to speak.
I might respond to that, Mr. Chairman. This piece of legislation was viewed as restricting DOT's hands in the Transportation Committee, especially with the number of projects that we have presently going. So in the committee, it was felt that it would not be fair to have this piece of legislation enacted immediately or even a year from now. So it was and there is a letter of intent that I don't know if the committee had received yet, but it was the intent to phase this formula in over a six-year period. And I might state that there are other problems in allocation of all transportation dollars, and you know, I could work with the subcommittee on this very issue, but I am also going to be working with the Transportation Committee. They are setting the allocation of all transportation dollars, aviation, highway, and other dollars, and they're going to be looking at this. They've placed that problem as one of their high priorities during the interim. And as I said, this committee should go ahead and do what they want to do on fair and equitable allocation of transportation dollars. But the Transportation Committee says that they are going to take that up, and this was a concern that was brought up by Representative Springer, and he plans on working with that subcommittee and coming up with possible alternatives. It was also the Transportation's committee's wishes to request and strongly request that DOT during the interim also look at this formula, and if they can come up with a better solution to address the what we feel is clearly some inadequacies in the present system. This piece of legislation only funnels the money in certain directions where I feel there are a lot of neglect, and redirects the state of Alaska back to the original intent of federal highway funds. It does not look at the ranking criteria. Presently, there is only one ranking criteria for all state dollars, and in my legislation, it will require DOT to come up with ranking criteria for all three different categories of federal money. That would be secondary, primary, and urban. so that the secondary needs of the state of Alaska that may require dirt roads and a low volume won't be competing with urban roads that may require paved roads and high volume use. I think that is one of the major problems with having one ranking criteria. The low volume roads in rural Alaska don't receive the enough points in order to be funded.
Thank you.
Representative Prashod and Reader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hoffman, I think I appreciate what you're doing here, and I think that that there is a case to be made that obviously by the chart that areas have been neglected with the federal highway funding. I think, though, that it's hard not to get argumentative on this subject, obviously, from which district one represents. The question of equity among funding, not just federal highway, but general fund monies and other types of federal aid money, has been before this legislature long before you and I were here. And every year, the chairman, Chairman Adams has scrupulously taken into account a lot of these factors in setting at least a plan for how capital dollars are allocated in the state. And since I've been here, it's been well known that Anchorage, my community, shares well in, although I see not as well maybe as other areas, but we certainly receive a substantial share of federal highway funds. We also receive substantially less general funds on a pro rata basis in the capital budget for as long as I can remember, and there is some acknowledgement that there are indeed federal funds going to Anchorage in addition to capital funds. The other thing, and of course we look in our capital budgeting for all capital budget needs throughout the state, not just highway needs, but obviously we look at school needs, we look at airports, we look at water and sewer, and in many cases rural areas are provided per capita much more monies for those based on real needs, and particularly schools and water and sewer, as compared to my community where I pay taxes on water and sewer. I pay taxes for school debt, which we just talked about earlier. So there are some of these other factors that come into play. Another misconception, by the way, bike paths are not eligible for federal funding for the past 5 or 6 years. There had been some, like along the Glen Highway previously, but that is not the case now. Those bike paths in conjunction with federal aid projects are paid by either municipal bond or state GF grant monies. Another problem, though, is that the allocative formula, which you're basing this on, which mimics the criteria for allocation by the federal system, while the bill follows this closely, we have to remember why it was we have that type of allocation in the federal system. It was through the diligence of our delegation whenever at every step of the way of revising the federal highway allocative statutes relative to the trust fund that we not be on a population basis. They added in a lot of these factors so that indeed Alaska would get a disproportionate share. If we just did population, as you suggest, you're right, we'd have a lot less highway funds. I hope none of us are arguing for less federal highway funds for Alaska. We've concocted the federal formula. We shouldn't be justifying it. I mean, it was concocted by the people who were back there at the time so that we would get a maximum amount of money. That's what we want. So to mimic that same allocation and say, well, you got to take land area into account within the reallocation within Alaska, there's no basis for that. There's no justification for it. What we should do, I think, is then go back to need. And some of those needs, I agree, there should be a way of addressing local road needs like the Bethel Airport Road, which I hope we will be addressing in this year's capital budget with federal preliminary engineering monies, and I support that. But when you talk about needs for roads, you can't ignore the pressing roads needs in urban Alaska. If you lived in Anchorage between 1983 and 1985, you can't argue that they were critical road needs, and then I think that was reflected in that period of time. When you have 30,000 people a day going by a road, it's got to compete favorably with much lower traffic counts in other areas. Those are pressing road needs, and I would hope that we would continue to address it on a needs basis, in addition, though, to taking into account some of these other concerns that probably have not been addressed.
Well, I guess I agree with you. Your what I view as a tainted view somewhat, but I think, you know, if we are a state of Alaska going to Washington, D.C. and asking them that we have special needs in Alaska, and 80% of our special needs are downtown Anchorage, I'd say that, you know, we're abusing the system. You know, if we say in Washington, D.C., we have special needs that have to be met, I'll contend that those special needs are in Macoryuk and Napakiak and Chivac and a lot of the other areas that the primary mode of transportation is three-wheelers and is snow machines. You know, those are the transportation, special transportation needs that this state faces when people are going from Oscarville to Bethel on a snow machine. And during the summer months, you go to those villages, you see how many roads they have. They don't have roads, they have a couple of boardwalks. You know, those are the special transport. We're not asking to build, overpasses and four-lane highways in rural Alaska. We're asking for primarily a dirt road with some gravel on it. And those villages don't have that right now. And I'm hard-pressed to be convinced that we as a state are going back to Washington, D.C., asking for special favors. If we have concerns and we've convinced Washington that we have special issues and concerns and we need a match of 10 to 1, by God, we should be implementing it as a state, and we as a legislature should be making those decisions. It shouldn't be a DOT that's making those decisions for us through a ranking criteria that is geared toward high volume roads and populated areas.
Representative Rieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My understanding is that the federal funds are allocated in the capital budget. Is that correct? I mean, in the past 20 years?
In the past couple of years, they've been included in the general operating budget, but this year it's going to be in the capital budget.
But, I mean, it's in a budget which is passed by the legislature.
Yes, it's in the budget passed by the legislature, but the projects that get in there are from the six-year plan, and the six-year plan is based on ranking criteria that is strictly set by DOT.
Don't we have the right to review and allocate according to, you know, I say we, the collective 40 representatives and 20 senators, the right to look at the needs and pass judgment and then craft a capital budget that allocates the federal funds as well as the general funds, depending on where we think that they should go?
Well, that may be the case, but, you know, you look at Bethel, and I know Senator Sackett and Senator Holman have been trying to get this project redesigned for Bethel, and I know that for a fact because I was the city manager in Bethel for those 8 years. We've been trying to get that road redesigned and reconstructed, and we were unable to do that because of the ranking criteria that was set by DOT, and I don't know what type of influence people like Senator Sackett and Senator Holman had in those days, but the road was not built because of what I think is problems with the system.
If I can continue. But this bill says the department shall allocate and expend the money. I mean, you're asking this to no longer go through the capital budget process and just, you know, dedicate this revenues according to a formula?
No, I'm saying that we should go through the capital appropriation process, but we should look at the needs of the state of Alaska, say that there are primary roads and secondary roads that need to be built. Let's develop, work with DOT and develop a ranking criteria that will address the needs. That's something that is not addressed in here in this piece of legislation, is what is the ranking criteria. And I go through the ranking criteria and I pass it out. I don't know if the members have that in their packets or been given that information, but the ranking criteria has to be looked at. When you say that in your ranking criteria that we're going to give 0 points for new road construction, that's a major policy issue that DOT is making. And I say that that's a major policy issue because one-third of the money that we get are for new road for road miles. And when we're not building new roads, we are hurting the formula funding that the federal government gives to us. I know the more roads we have, the more maintenance dollars we would have to have, but at the same time, we will be getting more federal highway funds if we have more roads. And that's a major policy issue that we, as a elected body, have been leaving to the to DOT.
I guess, my general feeling is, I guess that as time goes on here, each year I become more and more of a believer of the general fund concept and the not dedicated fund concept. And I've seen, there's unmet needs in every district in the state, and mine, yours, everybody else's, and I kind of like, how I've observed that the needs come together and they compete, on the table for amongst each other, and we get all the facts we can, and we figure out how the allocations should go, and I think that, maybe we don't do the best that could be done, but do the best we can, and the more that we tie it down and restrict and allocate and channel, the less flexibility we have to meet, the year-to-year changing needs of the state, and, it raises my antenna that we're unnecessarily restricting the way that funds go to where they wouldn't meet the most pressing needs on a year-to-year basis. So that's just an impression going in. I've as time goes on, I shy more and more away from dedicating things, and I read through here how different percentages shall go, and whether it helps or hurts my district, I know it sure won't help my district. But even if it didn't, I don't think this is the right way to go.
Well, maybe I could respond to that. This piece of legislation doesn't say which projects will get funded. If there are concerns in the state of Alaska, this bill does say that we should go back and look at primary routes. The road to the airport is a primary route. That should receive a higher priority than a road that benefits a few in the city of Juneau, going from a city street, and there are a lot of them, but the primary road should receive more priority than an urban road, and a secondary route for getting from one part of town to another part that's a major artery should receive more priority than an urban road. And that is what this piece of legislation does. It does not, you say that we have to leave ourselves flexible in deciding what projects get built within those categories. That is where the ranking criteria comes in. That's where we can be flexible and direct which projects gets funded. This bill says that we as a state of Alaska are going to be looking at the major funding funding dollars in an area that is of most importance to the state. And if you're saying that urban roads in the state of Alaska are more important than primary roads, then this piece of legislation isn't something that you should support.
Well, I guess I'm not trying to say that one is more important than the other. I'm trying to say that we should have the ability to look at the case by case. That's what we're down here for.
Case by case, and that's where the ranking criteria would come in, and we can go ahead and change that. This bill does not dictate what the ranking criteria will be.
I agree. I read it to say this bill says the department shall allocate and expend in accordance with a prescribed formula.
Right.
On
these road
points or legislative review. Or
on these road bases, but with if we take $80 million and say that's going to go to primary roads, that will just put it into a category, and then you go to the ranking criteria and find out which projects are going to be funded under that category. And DOT presently has that ranking criteria, and I agree with you, we should be doing that, but we're not doing that right now. That ranking criteria is something that the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities is designing and redesigning, and we don't have any say as a legislative body, or haven't in the past said new construction needs to be a priority, and we're going to change that ranking criteria. Or there are a lot of other issues, I guess, in their ranking criteria. there's four, one, two, three, four, five, six pages, seven pages of their ranking criteria, and we as a state aren't deciding that. We're leaving that up to up to DOT. And if you're, you know, if you're, if I can take your comments and say that we should be involved, then we should look at the ranking criteria and introduce legislation that can give them the flexibility. But we've given them ultimate control, and I don't think that that's right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Anybody else that would like to testify on this before it goes into subcommittee, consisting of Adams, Pushaw, and Frank? Since subcommittee. We're going to go for another half hour, and then any bills that we don't get to, we'll take up at 8 a.m. tomorrow morning. The next bill we've got is House Bill number 216, an act related to game farming. It's by Representative Larson and Menard. Currently, people are raising game birds without paying the required fee because it is too high for them to afford. This bill would lower the fees and hope that more people would actually purchase a license. If they do, the bill is expected to bring in a small amount of revenue, approximately $1,000. It does not cost anything to administer. Representative Larson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is one of the few revenue enhancement measures that we have had come before us this year. I might add, since it was before us last year, it has changed from a $600 negative over a two-year period of time to a $1,000 positive over the same period of time. But the purpose is principally, Mr. Chairman, to separate fish farming from game farming. The $200 annual fee as presently being charged is unreasonably high when you compare the same fee that is charged in other states. In fact, the fee is such that people are doing it illegally and they're not paying the fee. So as you notice on the fiscal note, it said by reducing the fee to a reasonable amount that's comparable to what is being paid in other states, that the folks who are already doing it will become more law-abiding citizens and will obtain a license and thereby live within the law. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions that anyone may have, but the committee may recall that this is one of the bills that died in Senate rules, I believe, in the closing seconds of last year.
Yes, on the bill.
Is this part of the adjournment plan?
It's part of the adjournment plan.
For some.
For some. Why not afford it? Yes,
I'd move the pass House Bill 216 with individual recommendations.
Is there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. The next bill we'll take up is House Bill 224. We have before us a committee substitute for number 224 Judiciary, an act related to the employment's rights based on pregnancy, childbirth, and adoption. This bill requires that employers provide parental leave. There is no additional cost to the state since state employees already enjoy this benefit.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is truly a motherhood bill, a parenthood bill, and I, since I've been working on this legislation, have come to believe that it's one thing that we can do to make long-term improvements in society and address such problems as juvenile crime and our correction system. And it gets, the theory is that you go to the very beginning of life and try to assure that a baby and its parents have the opportunity to spend some time together. Right now, the United States stands with South Africa, Upper Volta, and the Sudan as the countries in the world that do not have some type of mandatory family leave policy. Most countries in the world do have terms that are much more generous than what is proposed in this bill. The bill would provide that a new parent, male or female, could take up to 18 weeks of unpaid leave at the time of the birth or adoption of a child. It makes some other changes in the bill which are outlined in the material that's been presented to the committee. I have one amendment to propose, Mr. Chairman, to respond to a concern raised by Representative Frank. That's on page 3, line 17. This provision being addressed in subsection F would allow a pregnant employee to transfer to an existing unfilled position that was less strenuous or less hazardous under certain conditions. If the employee requested it, if the transfer is recommended by a licensed health care provider, and the employee is qualified to perform the job, and the transfer will not subject the employer to legal liability. And the concern expressed here was that if the employee, although qualified, was not trained or capable of immediately performing the job, that this could add to the burden on the small employer who will be trying to cope during that period when the employee is out. So I'm proposing to add the words "and able" on line 17 after qualified, so it would read the employee is qualified and able to perform the job in an attempt to address that. There's a lot that could be said, but I think I'll stop there and respond to any questions that the committee has.
I have a question. I have six children, and why is it taken from a maximum 9 to 18 weeks? What is different from having a baby a couple of years ago than it is today? Why do we need a longer time in here than present?
Yes, sir. The 18 weeks is patterned on federal legislation that's pending in Congress right now. I understand this 9 was added to the state statutes. The changes that are several years ago, the changes proposed on page 4 would be to conform the existing state provisions to the more generous provisions proposed in this bill. So I wasn't here and didn't hear the discussion, and I don't know that there's anything different necessarily, but that the idea is that you would give people the opportunity, which it's acknowledged that because the leave is unpaid, many people would not be able to afford to take that length of time off and may not choose to do so. But the fundamental issue, I think, is job security. Right now, when a woman has a baby and is responsible for the economic security of herself and the child, if she's a single mother, she cannot afford to risk losing her job. And so that's the main thing the bill provides, is the security that she could take the time off and have a job to return to.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's that time of the day, so I guess I'm going to say it. But sometimes when we look upon a period of 9 weeks or 18 weeks, Mr. Chairman, I think we have to look at the statistics of a recent survey that was made of elementary school children. And in that survey, the children are asked what they love most. And the children answered, "Mom first, hamburgers second, and Dad third." So maybe we have to give Dad more time at home so he can have equal status here. And I don't know how we can fix that in this bill.
I know what we could do. We could eliminate or we could prohibit McDonald's and Burger King from advertising hamburgers.
Well, of course, that is one of the provisions of the bill, is it would provide a father who's a new parent the same opportunity to take time off as a pregnant woman.
Any further questions?
Yes, I was thinking the father needed.
Gary, do you want to testify on this bill?
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Gary Jenkins. I represent the National Federation of Independent Business in Alaska. It's a national organization of some 500,000 members across the U.S. and slightly over 3,300 members in Alaska. And it is with some trepidation I take on motherhood. But we very strongly feel, both at the state level and at the national level, that this type of legislation is extremely poor public policy. Basically, the proponents are, arguing that there's a lot of benefits that will be gained at various levels of society and down to the female worker, and more specifically, if this legislation is passed. But I would argue that based on history, if one looks at the countries that have been predominantly mandated these type of benefits, which is the European countries, that the history does not support those arguments. And in your package, you have two primary handouts, one that has NFIB News on it, which is a copy of testimony at the national level by John Sloan, who's the president of NFIB, and then another one, parental leave, that's drafted under my name. But there are some charts that I would like to refer to in a few minutes. The general societal argument that's made by the proponents of this type of legislation is basically the imprinting concept and the benefits that come from imprinting which results from the mother and or father being home with the child for an extended period of time. However, the actual documented studies on this area show that for imprinting to really have value, the child needs to be with the mother or father for 1 year. And so 18 weeks hardly solves that problem or hardly effectively deals with it. I guess our feeling is if the state feels strongly that this would be good public policy, we would suggest that perhaps the state might want to set up a plan that any time a working mother gets pregnant, that they would reimburse the employer for her salary during the time that she's off, or pay her directly. I realize that would be a little spendy, but this will be an extremely expensive program for employers across the state if they are required to have mandated parental leave. Looking at the economic side of the issue, again, usually Europe has been brought up in the past as the countries to look at. But some statistics which has been gathered by our national office looking at Europe has tried to analyze this issue from a variety of different perspectives. I would first, in the handout that has the label news on the top of it, I would call your attention to initially chart 6, which is a comparison of what's been happening in the European nations as well as some of the other industrialized nations around the world since basically 1969 to 1984 in the area of employment, which is new jobs created, and GDP, which means basically capital investment. And looking at Europe, the second to the last column on the right side is a summary of all the European nations that are listed there. And basically what has happened in Europe is the employment change from 1969 to 84 has been a plus approximately 2% increase in net jobs created, while in the United States we have had about a net plus 30%, a very distinct difference. On the other side, what is in fact happening in these European countries is because business is having a difficult time dealing with these high costs, they are investing a very significantly higher portion of money into technology, which is the capital investments, which is the other line that's shown there of approximately 40% change over the last period of time. And so what's happening in Europe is they are going more and more to capital intensive or to technology improvements, which basically replace the need for people because of this high cost. There is also some charts going to charts 1 and 2, which compare the benefits cost to wages as a percentage. And again, it shows that the European nations are very high, you know, with Italy almost out to 100%. So for every dollar they pay in wages, they pay another dollar in mandated benefits. And
which chart are you on now?
This is chart 1 in that same group. Well, in the United States, the current is approximately 37%. Chart 2 is a little bit redundant from chart 6, and again, a little better clarity shows the percentage growth in employment. And this, what this is net new jobs created from 1969 to 1984. And again, Europe has had approximately 2% overall, while the United States has had, you know, roughly 33% increase. And we feel very strongly that this increase, first of all, there have been many studies done as where are the new jobs created in in the United States specifically, and the new jobs created by a vast margin are created by small businesses. The entrepreneur that decides he wants to go out and start a new business and starts hiring people. And in fact, the Fortune 500 over the past 3 years, I believe, have actually lost about 3 million net jobs across the United States. And looking at charts 3 and 4, chart 3 shows the unemployment rate for 1984 in these various countries and the percentage growth in the unemployment rate from 1970 to 84. Again, comparing the European countries with the USA, the black line is the unemployment rate growth, which has grown by approximately 5%, while in the U.S. it's grown by less than 1%, And while the unemployment rate itself for the European countries is roughly slightly over 10%, and the U.S. has stayed down to slightly over 6%. Chart 4 shows a mean average duration and basically shows the same pattern. I don't want to go over everyone in great detail. What we're seeing is a consistent pattern. Another argument that at least has been proposed, I don't believe it's been proposed before the legislature, but at the national level, is that this will allow more females to become part of the workforce, but that is also not supported by the statistics, as is shown in Chart 5, and that the U.S. has the third highest percentage of women already in the workforce and does not have a mandated parental leave policy. As you can see, this was for 1984. Sweden and Norway had slightly higher, with around 65 and then about 78% women involved in the labor force. But the U.S. was fairly close behind, with approaching 65%, and the other countries less than that. So there does not appear to be any kind of a direct correlation between the mandated leave such as this and the percentage of women in the workforce. Going to the next step, and that is, what is the impact on individual businesses? And the impact will be very significant. As the business gets smaller, having to replace an employee that's off for up to 18 weeks becomes a very significant expense. And, the argument is made, well, somebody else can fill in. Well, that just is not feasible in a variety of cases. And in most cases, and the employer is going to have to find somebody that can cover that job for that period of time. And so you have that cost, which is a significant cost. The other thing that this does is by mandating this as a benefit, it takes away the employer's option, which usually are a negotiated type thing with the employee, as to what benefits are most important to the employees. Typically, nationally, the primary benefit that employees are looking for is health insurance, and so that's typically the first one that's added. Well, with this kind of a mandated benefit added right on top, that will do one of two things. It'll either mean the employer will not provide health insurance, even though it may be the preferred benefit for a indefinite period of time, or the benefits provided could be, and most likely would be, significantly reduced. With regard to pulling our membership, we have found out two things also. As far as NFIB members who voted, 82% are opposed to this type of legislation. On the other hand, the question was also asked of what percentage of the businesses already provide some type of a paternity leave. And at the present time, almost 72% of the employers are in fact providing a paternity leave benefit. And it's at the present time, of course, a negotiated thing between the employer and the employee. Sometimes the impression is given by proponents that, they're just a bunch of employers out there that are really treating their employees poorly. They get pregnant, so they're fired immediately. And I just don't think that the true facts are supportive of that position. Lastly, I'd like to deal briefly with the impact on the female worker, and this is one.